The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks as always for subscribing, downloading, rating like I asked you to do last week. If you did, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be taking a tour through the solar system to explore volcanoes of fire and ice. Really looking forward to that with Natalie Starkey. Just a reminder that the FameLab final is on its way. If you know about FameLab, we've been supporting it for many years on News Talk. It's the International Science Communications competition where young scientists get up on stage and talk about their favorite science idea for 3 minutes. It's a really fun evening and it's coming up very, very soon. So if you want to watch, all you have to do is go to the British Council FameLab page. Just Google FameLab Ireland and you'll see details of how to watch the final. All right, time to look back at the week's science news. And here to join me is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, and from DCU, Dr. Susan Kelleher. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
We are seeing
vehicles pitching downrange.
The very first all-orbital civilian crew launching right now. Inspiration 4 now setting the standard for civilian orbital spaceflight.
T plus 30 seconds. Callouts indicate nominal. The Spark mission flying the Inspiration 4 crew onboard Dragon.
Is about space tourists, Shane.
Yeah, so this is part of the continuation of sending civilians into space. So the space industry now is dominated by billionaires who, rather than paying taxes, are more concerned about like sending rockets with huge carbon footprints up into space.
God, you bring this a lot of politics into this show, don't
no,
you?
No, Jonathan. I absolutely have had it with this sort of stuff. I don't give a crap about Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk sending. This is not science. This is just adventurism. And it's wrong. It's just ethically wrong. I really have strong feelings on it.
Is it not redistributing wealth a bit? Like there's a lot of charities getting money as a result of this, right?
No, it's just like, it's like greenwashing, you know. So they're involving a charity in it, for sure. And what's happened is an individual called Jared Isaacman has basically hired a Falcon 9 rocket and is sending sending four people into space. And those people have been selected through a lottery associated with a children's hospital. All sounds grand. And the people going are science communicators and an Air Force veteran. It all sounds great. But the question you have to ask is, why are they going? You know, there's no scientific merit in their adventure. They're just going into orbit for four days and coming back.
All right. Look, I get you, right? But like, people go to Bally James Duff. People go to Corfu and they travel to Bangkok and they go, why are they going? They go because it's an experience, it's a holiday. Is this not an inevitability that we will eventually put tourists in space? And why not these people? Why not in the name of charity?
It doesn't have to be an inevitability. And I think the comparison with going to Corfu or Bally James Duff it only goes so far, because like the cost on the planet, the implications for everyone else of a trip to Bally James Duff, which is a lovely place, by the way,
they're
tiny. Yeah, exactly. They're tiny. But like, for sending four people into space, the amount of fuel that has to be used, the amount of money that could, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. Like,
well, hang on. The flight isn't hundreds of billions of dollars.
No, but the technology that goes into
But they already have the technology.
You know?
They built the technology. He's actually made it a factor of 10 cheaper. Look, I'm playing devil's advocate. I do think it's a bit stupid, but I do think it's inevitability that some people are going to go to space. And it's like,
do you know
it's
what?
Like fighting the ocean.
I give the last word to my great colleague, Peter Gallagher. We don't need to send humans into space if we want to do science. We can send robots. You can do everything you need to do. We can discover all the things we want to discover and more. It's just boys and their toys. That's it.
All right. Susan, our second story is another... some rich
We're
people
grumpy today,
have decided...
Jonathan.
Well, no, I mean, I was fine. I started the show fine. Shane's the one who dragged me down. But this, I agree, is a really stupid... I mean, they're both... They're both wastes of money, but this is a colossal waste of money.
Yeah,
it is. The revival of the woolly mammoth is upon us.
The saga has not finished yet, unfortunately. And as you said, this is happening because a company aptly named Colossal has raised $15 million to try and have another go at this, bringing back the woolly mammoth from extinction. Their plan is to use gene splicing to insert mammoth-specific genes extracted from woolly mammoth specimens that were frozen into skin cells of the Asian elephant. Mm-hmm. And they're then going to create a nucleus that can then be implanted into an egg that's been modified to be able to grow this new species. The Asian elephant is 99.6% similar in terms of genetics to the woolly mammoth. And then they're hoping to be able to create a sort of a hybrid woolly mammoth Asian elephant species.
Numbers obviously are slightly, I mean, it's 99.6% is very similar, but aren't we like 99 or 98.9 chimpanzees? So those are two very different species. So 99.6 is miles off.
Yes, but they're definitely closer than we would be in terms of a woman that may be a surrogate. I don't think I'd be choosing that egg to implant.
I think if you try to use a cat to birth a young woolly mammoth, that would certainly not work out well for the cat. There's a whole load of ethical problems with this, mm-hmm. which I want to touch briefly because I actually want to talk about the plan here. So very briefly, ethical problems are what the hell
is this mammoth going to do? The first thing is to grow the egg. So like even if it was implanted into an Asian elephant, and they themselves are endangered, so like the chances of it taking and being able to grow to the size that needs to grow is difficult. So they've also actually tried to create an artificial womb, think sort of Matrix pod-esque thing where, you know, they're going to try to grow this. So that's not, you know, that's not going to, I don't know if that's likely to work, and it's certainly not particularly where our resources should be going.
Not with 15 million to create.
No,
I mean, I know there are.
For one.
But I'll tell you, you know, if they figure that, that could be the Teflon from the moon thing. Because if you find a way to be able to incubate a fetus outside the womb, that would be huge.
Yeah.
But that probably should be the mission, not.
Yes. And they say as well from, you know, this would be bringing. So from the ethics point of view, just back to that, they also bringing this woolly mammoth back. Their argument is that they'll be able to rewild it into the Arctic tundra, where it can go back and essentially right some ecological imbalances that have caused some sort of issues with climate crises now. So they're essentially thinking that this is going to, you know, have a positive effect on our planet. And I think that's a big step, a big leap to be able to say that, let alone, I mean, the woolly mammoth obviously was, you know, a part of a certain environment back, you know, many, many thousand years ago. But I mean, that environment's changed now. So whether or not that mammoth could even live there now, for example, they've also made the argument that they might help the Asian elephant to adapt to colder climates. I mean, I think there's a lot more we can do for the Asian elephant than Shane,
I know you. I know you want to jump in here, but
incorporated.
Just save the
existing animals.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. But what is hugely problematic for this is that the arguments against this are so convincing and total that these rich people have decided that they can say, you know, like you create one animal, that animal will not be able to breed, it will die. That's, you know, that's the thing over. It's both cruel and, you know, even if the animal lives to an adult age, it lives in a solitary, strange world and brought back from a time long, long ago. Secondly, the number of Asian elephants, I presume, that we have to produce this is not loads. Like, we don't have billions of elephants to spare to basically just...
No.
Give it a go, right? So, I mean, the arguments against this are so big, it's mad that they've said, yeah, we're going to do it anyway.
I mean, they have shown with some endangered species, as an example of a black ferret, that they've done this cloning and they've been able to produce a clone. But I mean, they, you know, the animal isn't extinct yet. So, you know, it's a very different story. The technology is there and it's being used in a positive way. But this just seems a little bit like toys for boys again. Sorry to use such phrases.
And we are miles off being able to actually do this. But you need the full DNA to even give it a good whack. Shane, our third story... has to do with being very cold.
Yeah, perhaps the first actual science story we've covered today, which is about a new low temperature record. 38.
Are you accusing this program of being lowbrow?
No, never. But I think certainly, you know, those two headliners have been a little bit sensationalist, but they're great stories and it's interesting to talk about them for sure. But this one is done in Germany and they have used 100,000 rubidium atoms. They've cooled them remarkably and they've been doing experiments with them. And basically temperature is a measure of how fast the constituent parts of anything are moving. It's a measure of the speed of the constituent atoms. And as temperature falls, they move less. And as you get to a very low temperature, you can form new states of matter. One, a famous one, is called the Bose-Einstein condensate, where all of the constituent element atoms behave as one quantum unit. And that allows us to understand the quantum nature of matter. It allows us to build the most accurate ruler in the universe called an interferometer, which is able to measure things to 1 nanometer. And the way they do this is they take the Bose-Einstein condensate, right, and they drop it. So they just drop it down 110 meters of a specially built place in Germany, drop tower, which sounds great.
Why do they drop it?
So they do that to see the effects of gravity on the Bose-Einstein condensate as it falls. And you're able to measure the gravitational constant very accurately that way. So the scientists here weren't driven to go to low temperatures. They were driven to make the ruler. It was a consequence of how they worked that they achieved the lowest temperature possible. So really the headline here is scientists develop the world's or the universe's most accurate ruler. As a consequence, it's really, really cold.
Does dropping it make it colder?
No, in fact, dropping it would heat it up.
Yeah.
But what they have done is that they have used magnetic fields and turned them on and off as it drops so that it doesn't expand, that this Bose-Einstein condensate doesn't expand as it falls, and they're keeping it coherent, which is a particularly scientific term.
Susan, our final story has to do with old clothes.
Yeah, so the question of, you know, when humans started wearing clothes is, you know, still up for debate. And this new evidence has come out. Of course, clothes are hard to, they don't sustain, they degrade very quickly. So we have to look for evidence of clothes. So through the years, different ideas have come up and different evidence. And this paper has just shown that they found essentially the tools that were used to cut the fibers of hide and leather. And it's around 120,000 years ago from a certain dig that took place in Morocco. Similar to Shane's story, it's very nice because they didn't go in looking for this. They went in looking for these bones to get an understanding of whether or not they were used for food preparation back then. And then they've kind of decided and figured that based on the way that they're shaped and fibers and different things that were found on them, that they were very likely used for cutting leather and cutting hide for, and they assume then you're going to be wearing that or using it as shelter in general, waterproof materials.
So how long ago then does that put the wearing of clothes as far as we know?
120,000 years ago. So it's really on the end of kind of what was expected from the evidence found so far. So, you know, it's definitely one of the earliest times that we were wearing it.
It's probably hard to tell just from the tools what sort of clothes they were wearing 120,000 years ago, but actually, we've probably seen it this week at the Met.
Yes.
all right. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, from DCU. Dr. Susan Kelleher, thanks very much for joining us. Sometimes I think it's fair to say we get the idea that we are all powerful, indestructible, in fact. But just step outside and Mother Nature can very quickly remind you of the awe-inspiring forces that are all around us. And that power is exemplified perfectly in volcanic activity that we see every year across the planet. But what about other planets? Are the volcanoes found there just as violent and forbidding? Well, Natalie Starkey is a science writer and author of Fire and Ice, The Volcanoes of the Solar System. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Natalie. Tell me about the book. Why did you want to write it?
Thank you for having me. I've always been absolutely fascinated by volcanoes from a very young age. And I think that's maybe quite common for small kids to be excited about volcanoes. And then as I got older, I started to learn, you know, how dangerous they are. And for some reason, it didn't put me off wanting to study them, even though, you know, I heard these stories about, you know, people getting caught in pyroclastic flows, hurtling down the side of a mountain. And I visited Pompeii and saw, you know, the real evidence of what had happened to that whole town during a massive eruption at Vesuvius. But, you know, even though I don't consider myself much of a risk taker, for some reason, it just didn't put me off wanting to be on volcanoes, collect samples on them and study them and understand why they erupt and what that can tell us about the Earth as a whole.
Have you ever been very close to a volcano that that could be very deadly? Because it's so hard sometimes to figure out when these things are going to erupt, right?
Yeah, exactly. Forecasting eruptions is obviously a massive science that's really important because there's a lot of population in the world that live very close to volcanoes for many reasons, because the land around them is actually very fertile. So it's great for growing crops and things. So when you're studying volcanoes, and if you want to understand how to forecast when they're going to erupt, you pretty much have to get up close to them to, you know, put seismometers around them to understand the earthquakes that are happening, measure the temperature and the gases that are coming out of them. So I've actually had the opportunity to do that on a small Caribbean island called Montserrat, which is a British overseas territory. And it's this island that's about 10 kilometers long. It's very small, and most of it is made up of the active volcano at the present day. And famously, in about 1995, the eruption started and destroyed the whole of the city of Plymouth, which was the capital at the time. And everyone had to be evacuated out of there. Now, luckily, it was one of those times when scientists got it right. And they, a few weeks ahead, were pretty sure a massive eruption was going to happen, managed to evacuate everybody out of there. There were a few people that died in the eruption who refused to leave. But, you know, overall, it was a success case. But that volcano is going to continue erupting now. It's always going to be very dangerous. And so as scientists, we have to go there and study it, get on its flanks and, you know, poke it and try and find out what it's going to be doing in the future. So yes, it's a phenomenal experience being that close to such a big mountain that is literally, you hear it kind of roaring because of the gases escaping from it. It's a weird experience, but for some reason I kind of felt safe. I trusted that the scientists I was working with knew that I was in a, you know, it wasn't going to erupt imminently, that they checked all the data and that, you know, we were safe for that few hours we were there to do our measurements and everything.
And that preferably you'd prefer not to go up in flames while doing your work.
We had these like boiler suits on, which I'm not sure, you know, I spoke to them about it. I was like, well, how long would this give me? And they said, it might give you an extra few minutes of life, but you probably wouldn't want that because, you know, you're probably be in some pyroclastic flow or something. So yeah, you kind of put it out of your head when you're there and just enjoy the beauty of being close to a volcano.
So before we talk about volcanoes outside of Earth, tell me, how do they happen on Earth? Is it always the same way, the tectonic plates pushing towards each other? Is that always how we get?
That's not the only way. That's the really cool thing about Earth, actually. We have plate tectonics, and we think we're the only planet or moon within the solar system to have had plate tectonics. And this just means that our surface of our planet is constantly being renewed. And you're exactly right. Two plates, basically pieces of crust, can move towards one another, and one ends up below another one, and it sort of promotes melting in the mantle below, which is kind of the rocky material below the crust, and it creates volcanoes at the surface. But we also get volcanoes at mid-ocean ridges, where down the North Atlantic is a great example, where two plates are moving apart, and we create a line of volcanoes that basically goes around the whole of the Earth. So there's two types, and they are very Earth-centric, so we don't see those types anywhere else. Now, we have another type, which is, I usually give Hawaii as the example of these, because we all understand the Hawaiian island chain, and current activity in Hawaii is based on the Big Island, where the volcanoes of Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea are. And that is what we call a mantle plume. So this is a big chimney of hot rock that rises from the core, basically from the outside of the core of our planet, thousands of kilometers deep. And it comes up through the mantle and gets to the crust and erupts hot magmas on the crust. And obviously in Hawaii, it starts under the ocean, builds up until it gets above the ocean. So Mauna Kea is actually enormous. It's about 11 kilometers in height if you measured it from its base, but the bit you see above the ocean is, you know, only 4 kilometers. It's still massive, but they create really big volcanoes, but they're very wide. It's a very kind of runny lava that's produced, so they're quite wide but still very high.
And so when we look beyond Earth, then there obviously the planets in our solar system are made of very different materials. And so do we see the same sort of volcanoes in something like Mars or Venus or the other rocky planets?
Yeah, so the rocky planets all started out pretty similar. They've got the same kind of starting ingredients, and they formed in a similar part of the solar system, fairly close to the sun. The main difference is their size. So Venus is pretty similar in size to Earth. And so it is still active at the present day. It's still got volcanoes. And actually, it has these kind of mantle plume volcanoes, much like we find in Hawaii.
How do we know that? Was it flyby photos or...?
Yeah, I mean, it's very tricky with Venus because it's got this horrible atmosphere, which we can't see through with visible light. So we have to use radar. And actually, we've never seen a volcano erupting on the surface. But there's a lot of evidence that the surface of Venus is relatively new, geologically speaking. So we don't see lots of craters. So if you look at the moon and you have a nice telescope, you can see lots of craters across the surface, which indicates it's a very old surface. It's been bombarded by comets and asteroids. And it's not been able to do anything about that and cover them over. Whereas on Venus, we see circular features, but they're not craters. They're more likely to be kind of where mantle plumes have come up and created volcanoes. But we're still yet to see an eruption happen at Venus. But there is a lot of evidence that they are happening at the present day, which is really exciting.
In terms of the, remind me of the orbit of Venus, does it get very, very cold in Venus? Like, do you need certain temperatures to have volcanic flows, or can you have volcanic eruptions with ice, for example?
Yeah, so with Venus, it's always very hot. Its surface, because of its atmosphere, it's basically a runaway greenhouse effect. So its surface is 450 degrees Celsius. It's, you know, completely life inhibiting. And it does affect how the volcanoes flow, or how the lavas flow that come from them. They can go a very long way. So if you see like those beautiful images of Venus, which we have of the surface, it looks like rivers running across the surface, but actually it's lava flows, and they can just flow a really long way. But they're probably a similar composition to what we have on Earth. It's just ours don't flow as far because we're a bit cooler and we have different conditions. But sure enough, when we go out to the outer solar system, we don't have worlds made of rock. So they're rocky in the middle. They've got a rocky core, much like all of the other planets. But the outside of them is made of ice. But it doesn't mean we don't see volcanoes in these places. They just act and behave slightly differently to the ones that we find on, say, Venus or Mars or Earth.
In what way?
So basically, what we need to create volcanoes on worlds is some kind of heat. You need some heat inside a planet or a moon to move material around. Now, if you're talking of icy material, it doesn't take as much heat to move that, because if you're talking about melting some water ice or ammonia ice, you only need a small temperature rise to make that happen. Whereas if we're talking rock, obviously you need temperatures of over 1200 degrees Celsius to try and melt it and move it around. So actually, even though these bodies outside in the outer solar system are very cold, again, it doesn't take much to move that material. So what we find, if we take, I don't know, Enceladus, which is the moon of Saturn, as an example, we call it an ocean world, because although the outside of the world is frozen solid and it's an icy surface, we think it has a massive ocean underneath that. And then it's also got a rocky core, which is warm. Now, this environment is really interesting to scientists because we think special reactions happen between the hot rocky core and the base of this kind of salty ocean. Now, we have evidence we've got a salty ocean because the Cassini mission, which is a NASA mission, actually flew through plumes of material that were erupting off and out of Enceladus. And it basically tasted what was in these plumes, and it got salty grains, it got silica, which is indicating that there's reactions happening with the rock. And they also detected organic particles in there. So there's an awful lot coming out of this ocean and indicating that there's some kind of active system at the bottom of the ocean, which is really exciting for the prospects of things like life, because we think it's a very similar environment to our mid-ocean ridges, where potentially life started on Earth. We still don't have an answer to that massive question in science, but it's one of the things that scientists are looking at as to where life started. So, you know, these places are really cool to start investigating.
What about even further still to somewhere like Neptune or Jupiter?
Yeah, so we'll take Jupiter first. It's, you know, the biggest planet in the solar system. So it has a huge amount of gravity associated with it. And it's got, I think, like 79 moons. It's got loads of moons hanging around it. But the Galilean moons are probably some of the most interesting in terms of the volcanoes, because what happens is they all orbit around this massive gravity body, and they get kind of pulled and tugged as they go around their orbit. And the effect this has is what we call tidal heating. The insides of, say, Io or Europa, which are two of the moons, get kind of squashed and squeezed as by the gravity of Jupiter. So it's kind of kneading the insides of the planets. And the friction that happens with these rocks kind of rubbing against each other creates heat. And that is literally what fuels the volcanoes at the surfaces. So Io is actually the most volcanically active object in the solar system. And weirdly, it's not made of ice. It is a rocky object. And it's kind of weird. It's the weird one out in the outer solar system. It's more similar to Earth or the moon or something. But it's so active. In fact, the Voyager missions that were kind of out in the 1970s and 80s, they did two flybys and they saw 9 eruptions happening during this time. So it's incredibly active. And it's a really good window into understanding what the early Earth was like, because we think it's very similar to what our planet was like 4 billion years ago. So, you know, it's a great place to study. And Europa, again, it's a bit like Enceladus. It's this icy world with this big ocean. In fact, it's got more liquid water on Europa than we have on our own planet. So it seems like this small moon, but actually in terms of what could be going on in that ocean, you know, the possibilities are endless, and we really need to get down there, you know, hopefully with a mission one day and investigate into that ocean, see what's happening.
Really cool. What about our planet that we kicked out then, lowly Pluto, which for a long time we thought was quite uninteresting until we finally got images of it only a few years ago. And it's such a beautiful, I was going to say planet, but dwarf planet.
I still call it a planet.
Yeah. Is there anything going on Pluto?
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because the New Horizons mission set off when Pluto was still a planet, and it got demoted during New Horizons' journey out there.
So no one's told the Voyager.
Yeah.
No one's updated them on the science.
It's crazy. And so, you know, all we had of Pluto before New Horizons got there was this kind of very blurry image. It was kind of, we really couldn't see much about it. So we assumed Pluto being so far from the sun that it was going to just be cold and dead and, you know, nothing was much happening. And sure enough, you know, the New Horizons mission opened up like our view of Pluto amazingly, because even just with a quick flyby of Pluto and some of its moons, we suddenly saw that it wasn't this cratered body like the moon. It's got like a geologically interesting terrain. It's got mountains and nitrogen glaciers, and it's got these smooth plains where we see things happening. So we've got basically material upwelling and then creating these features on the surface. So we know that there's some kind of heat within Pluto. And at the moment, we don't understand where that heat comes from, because it's not next to a big planet where it could be kind of jostled around and create heat within it. And even more excitingly, its moons, one of them is called Charon, which I always think is quite a funny name for a moon. But it's also not a cratered surface. And it's this tiny moon, you know, a moon of a very small dwarf planet. And it should be cold and dead, but it's not. And it's not cratered, and it's we see ammonia on the surface, which should break down within, you know, tens of thousands of years, and it hasn't. The fact it's still there means that it's been erupted fairly recently. So there's so much going on, and it's amazing how much we can learn by just flying past a planet. Now, we need to go back to Pluto and investigate in more detail. I think that's what New Horizons has shown. You know, we've opened up these outer solar system worlds and just gone, oh goodness, there's so much we don't know about them. But yes, it's got volcanoes. You know, we think it's a cryovolcanic world, which is really exciting.
This might be a really stupid question, but if a planet has mountains, does that mean that it will also have volcanoes, or are there ways that mountains are formed that are completely different and do not belie some sort of volcanic activity underneath?
Yeah, I think on the whole, if you see big mountains, you're going to know that world has been active, but it doesn't necessarily have to have had volcanoes. So if we take Mercury, for example, it's no longer active volcanically, but it's still it's actually contracting because it's cooling down. So it has what we call tectonic events, which just means like the plate of the outside of that world is still kind of moving. So you can create valleys and scarps and therefore sort of features on the surface which could look like mountains. So yeah, I think volcanoes help because they show us that world is definitely warm inside still and capable of creating features on the surface, but you wouldn't need them to have mountains.
Where in our solar system, as far as we're aware, where is the largest volcano? And can you give us an idea of the size of that?
Yeah, so it's Olympus Mons on Mars, actually, and it's extinct today. It probably last erupted billions of years ago, but it's absolutely enormous. It's 25 kilometers high, but it's also very wide. So if we go back to the example of Hawaii, it's actually a very similar type of volcano to the ones that we see in Hawaii. It's these shield volcanoes, as they're called. And they're called that because it looks like a warrior's shield lying on the ground, very wide and very flat, but incredibly big. So they are high. Now, the reason that Mars can have such a big volcano is because it's got much less gravity than our own planet, because it's half the size of our planet. So it just means that mountains can grow higher. If we put Olympus Mons on Earth, it would collapse under its own weight. It would just be too big. And it's formed by exactly the same thing we find at Hawaii, one of these mantle plumes, these chimneys of hot rock rising up through the planet and just erupting material for billions of years on the surface. And it's just been able to grow really large.
There are, through history, some volcanic eruptions that have completely changed the planet, albeit sometimes for only a few years. Krakatoa and potentially that enormous volcano that lies underneath Yellowstone. And I'm wondering, do we know of any super volcanoes that that do exist on other planets that could change the way we see it under a telescope? Is that possible with some of the other planets, because of maybe their heat, that those sort of eruptions might be much more devastating than they might be here on Earth?
So I don't think there's super volcanoes as such on other planets, partly because our super volcanoes are created because of plate tectonics, and we have to have magma sitting around in the crust for quite a while to generate gases, and that's what creates the explosivity. And that probably doesn't happen, it probably isn't going to happen on any other planet today, but one of the really interesting ones is Venus, because what we think happens is that because it doesn't have plate tectonics, the outside of its crust is all basically one piece. It's called a stagnant lid planet. And this means it essentially kind of insulates all its heat inside. So it's got the same amount of heat to get rid of as Earth, and we're erupting all the time and getting rid of it. But Venus kind of insulates it. And what ends up happening, we think, is that maybe every kind of 500 million years, it has this massive eruption. So basically the whole planet just starts having eruptions all over it, creating what we call flood basalt. So this is just basalt is a type of lava that comes out, and it resurfaces the whole of the planet in one go. So it would be completely mad to be there at the time. It's over geological timescales. It happens over about 100 million years, but the whole of the surface of the planet gets changed. So that is kind of a super volcano, but for the whole planet. That's like nothing we've ever seen on Earth, to be honest. So that hasn't, you know, we can see the evidence for that. That happened about 500 million years ago. So, you know, there are still volcanoes going off on Venus, but not at quite the same rate as they were at the time. But that, yeah, that's quite an exciting thing to be happening there.
My understanding is the magnetic fields of Earth, at some point in the not hugely distant geological future, the polarity is going to reverse and they switch around. And I'm wondering, will that have any effect on active volcanoes, or are volcanoes not affected by the Earth's magnetic field at all?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I guess we don't really know. It's hard for us to kind of see that in the geological record. We can see that the polarity of the rocks changes, because when the polarity changes of the planet, when rocks are erupted, they contain iron within them. Iron is a very common element that they contain. And basically the little grains of iron kind of line up with the current polarity of the planet. So we can see that on the mid-ocean ridges, as though it's like a conveyor belt. If you take two plates apart and you've got magma being produced in between, it naturally aligns with the polarity. So we end up getting stripes across the ocean in terms of polarity as that plate moves away, and we can kind of see that the polarity of the Earth has changed. But in terms of it affecting volcanoes actually erupting, I don't think it would have any effect on them. But it would have massive effects on our modern world, let's say. I think it would be complete mayhem.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, the least of which is cows looking the other direction when they graze. Isn't that right? The cows graze in the direction of the magnetic field.
I've heard that dogs also align when they do their business. They align with. I don't believe it though. I tried to watch my dog do it. I'm like, no, there's no rhyme or reason.
Really interesting speaking with you, and it's a really fascinating book about some of the most violent and fascinating geological events happening across our solar system. It's called Fire and Ice, the Volcanoes of the Solar System. Natalie Starkey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
She was brilliant, wasn't she? You can see some of those images of volcanoes and other planets that have been taken on various space missions on our Twitter page. It's at News Talk Science. Looking back at some of your comments from last week, we were talking about landing on Mars and why it's so tricky, because the soil is so loose that when you land with the thrusters, they make a huge crater and then the crater collapses, or you can't get stable, or all that rubble is really tricky. The sand gets everywhere, like when you're at the beach and fooling around. So we have some texts in. One person says, why not use retractable wings like the space shuttle and glide the last bit down? The problem is there isn't enough of an atmosphere to give you that resistance to glide down safely, unfortunately. And Colm says, I haven't heard the simple expedient of melting Martian moon dust with just lensing sunlight, which is much more powerful in thin atmosphere. He did mention it. I wondered, did it get cut out in the edit? He did say that one of the ways we might create a landing pad is by actually melting the dust by using the power of the sun and creating sort of a hardened glass landing pad for these missions. So it has been thought of. And Ina Defui says, is Mars not just an example of solar power drying a planet out, and we're next? The early signs being global warming. No matter what we do, the sun is going to prune us good. No? Questions. the world will eventually be consumed in the supernova of our sun exploding, is my understanding, at some point. The drying out of Earth is an interesting question, because I'm not sure, but I think there's still the same amount of water on the planet as there always was. I don't think the amount of water changes. It just moves around. So I don't know if technically in the planet itself we have less water than we used to. I think it just takes different forms. But actually, that's something I might... go and explore. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to Aid McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, and on sound, Steve McClune. We'll be back with more Future Proof next Saturday on Future Proof. In the meantime, stay curious.